This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at the Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2024, held at Ephrata Business Center in Ephrata, Pennsylvania, on March 1 and 2, 2024.
All right, so maybe you've thought about, if you've come to any number of CASBs over the years, that this why teach is kind of a recurring theme that we do. And I don't know when I first went to a CASB years ago, and they were even doing the core subjects like why teach math, which seems very obvious. But we've kind of decided that we're going to do that. That's going to be a theme of CASB, to go through the subjects every year, pick a few, and why teach. So obviously this is one of them. Sitting around trying to decide, what should we do yet? And we come up with recess and economics and world cultures. So here we are. Come on in. Yep, have a seat. Maybe this seems very obvious to you. It does to me. I would not want to offend you if you came really seriously wondering why would I bother. For me, the question is more, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you teach this subject? Come on in. Sorry, the only seats left are clear across the room. We Mennonites are famous for that. It's a cultural thing. Oh, yes. Anyway, they're all free. All seats are free. All right, so why wouldn't you? Why would you deny children this experience? So for all the subjects that we teach in school, sometimes in the yearbook, we have this little profile that the graduates do. And one of those profile questions is, what was your favorite subject? If you would go back through the yearbooks, this one is often at the top, up there with algebra and maybe world history. So it's a very popular subject with students. And I've had some students who did not like history, but they liked this one. And I've asked them, okay, you don't like history, why do you like this? Oh, it's more practical, which is supposed to be the correct answer for all Mennonites, right? It's practical. And I really don't think they were honest. I think what they were trying to tell me is they just liked it. It's just fun. Okay, it's fun studying about people. All right, so I think maybe the question really is, how do you make time for it? This is one of the problems we have. Every year you come to CASB and some speaker gets up and sells another subject that you got to go home and learn how to plug into the system. And if you come to enough of CASBs, you're going to be so convinced that everything is so vitally important. And so it becomes a question of priorities. So I'm willing to discuss here questions you have about prioritizing and the correct way to do that. Maybe we have a little diagram that we'll work through. Now, come on in, there's still some seats. I don't like, the colors are so washed out on this thing that I think maybe we can almost get by without the lights. If you all can't write, there's still enough light to write. All right, that maybe help our colors a little bit. And I don't, if I can't see your faces, that'll help me. All right. Okay, so I have some very obvious reasons. They're so obvious, you're going to wonder why you even got to write them down. Maybe a few that you didn't think about, but I basically tried to keep it to very one or two word reasons. You can kind of fill them in at the top. And then maybe we'll look at a diagram on prioritizing. And for the most part, I just tried to keep this interesting and let's just enjoy looking at geography and world cultures. Kind of an afternoon break, maybe. Okay, so it is a beautiful world, and God made it so. A beautiful world with a beautiful work to do. When God assigned the creation mandate, He meant it to be an enjoyable work for man. And when children come into this world, they come into this place and they come into this work. Why would you deny children the opportunity to learn about the place to which they have been called to work? And so it is a part of the creation mandate. Does anybody, just because this is geography class, does anybody know where this picture, where in the world you would find this? And I'll quiz you a couple times just because it's fun. Who knows where this is? Beautiful place. It's one of those places that if you went to, you would say, pictures just don't do justice. Okay, what'd you say? Okay, you're close. You are close and you're in the right geographical landform. But you got to go further north.
Banff.
You got to go further north. Which one's above Banff yet?
Jasper.
Anybody ever been there? Been to Banff, Glacier, Jasper, those kind of places. Beautiful, gorgeous places. And there's a reason the mountains are shaped the way they are. This is actually Lake Maligny, and my dad chose that as back in the 80s when it was popular to do wallpaper on one wall of your house and a big picture. Maybe some of you remember that. We don't do it so much anymore, but that I grew up with that in our living room. And so I've always wanted to go there and never have, but stared at that mountain all my growing up years. All right, so creation mandate would be the first reason. And so the world is beautiful, and it's a beautiful work we have been given, but we live in a fallen world. And so we mean well, and the work is fun, but once in a while we just pass right out, and it's difficult. And so we have these interesting cultures that have taken shape, and our world's work is frustrating because of the fall. Incidentally, another quiz, does anybody know what is going on here? What culture is that? What country? That's right. Okay, so they stand so erect, knees locked, and if they pass out and drop over and knock out their teeth, the guard on either side will continue to stand. Crazy. Because the queen passes by. All right, and another fallen world situation. Maybe someone knows what's going on in this picture. This is a place where the greatest exodus of people in the world happens. Pretty vague, I know.
Mecca.
Good. And now you're one step closer. Does anyone know what is going on? There's a story in Mecca, Muslim tradition, where Muhammad was with Gabriel, and Satan came to attack him. Very similar, by the way, to Jesus' three temptations. And as Satan came, Gabriel said, pick up stones and pelt him. And that happened three times. And it was because he was trying to resist the temptation to not sacrifice Ishmael. And so as a tradition, these people go to Mecca, and one of the things they do while they're there is walk by these big walls, and they all hurl stones at it. And yes, people get hurt and things like that. And so thousands and thousands of people, they've had to build the three tiers up so people can walk by because they were having so many people getting hurt with stones. That's just amazing. All right, so a fallen world in spite of it being very beautiful, and that is the tension that we work with. All right, so that's one. My next reason is just simply enjoyment. It's just fun. I mean, there's no real reason to know about this, but it's fun. Okay, so who knows what's going on here?
Spain.
Good, and?
Running of the bulls.
And why would you ever? What is it about culture that creates such strange traditions? And who would ever get a camera down that close in front of a charging bull and take a picture? And by the way, I spared you all the bloody ones. There's some that I would have loved to have shown, but I was afraid someone would get queasy. So, yep, they got paramedics there, and someone is almost always hurt. And yet they do it every year. Spain. Can someone name the culture? There's various cultures in Spain, and this one actually bleeds over in across into the Pyrenees. And it is the... It's called the Basques, and they're the ones that wear those neat little red fedora hats, like Basques. Okay, it's enjoyable. And the scenery is enjoyable, and almost all students leave this course dreaming of going somewhere on their honeymoon. one of the big ones is this one. Oh man, my girl, she saw me putting this presentation together, and she came down and she went, "Ah, oh, I need to go there." Who knows where this is? I'm sorry? Greece, yes. It is an island in Greece. It's actually an old extinct volcano. So this resorts are built on the sides of the old extinct volcano. Santorini, Greece. So a lot of these kind of pictures come up in your Windows, you know, thing now, and it always has you know, clickbait stuff. Do you know where this picture is? All that. Maybe you click on it, maybe you ignore it. Anyway, beautiful places, and it's enjoyable to study. All right, another reason would be integration. Maybe a bigger word, but this is important, I think. Sorry, my color's really washed out on this diagram, but when I was in school taking the old CLE material, and some of you probably did too, we had a course called Social Studies. And that's how this course was completely wrapped up. So everything else that you didn't know where to categorize, you just kind of dumped it in the Social Studies camp. And so you can integrate so many things into this course: history, geography, family, politics, economics, religion, arts, technology, literature, nature. All of this stuff is integrated into social studies. And so here is where all the subjects merge back together. In school, we have so many things to study, and so we break them apart into categories and we analyze all the parts. But sometime, you need to really put it all back together. So it is important to analyze, but it's even better to synthesize. And this is a subject that puts it all back together. So integration is another reason why you should study world cultures. All right, here's a map that my students are very familiar with. It's called a black line map. And I don't know how many of those countries you could yell out. You're probably okay on the left over here, but you get down into the Shatter Belt and that would get the Balkans would be a little tougher maybe. So you all are old enough to remember the chaos in this country here. Can someone name that?
Bosnia.
Yes, you got it. That's it. That's Bosnia. And we remember the days when we went to school. This whole area was easy to learn because that was all Yugoslavia. And today it consists of about 7 or 8 or 9 different countries. So the students today, when it's time to fill out the Europe on the test, got to do a little review. So one of the things that I struggle with in teaching this subject is how much time do I give to review and how much time do I give to let's just explore and make it interesting. I don't know. What kind of teacher would you like? Would you like a teacher who taught for 20 minutes and then spent another 20 minutes reviewing? Or would you rather just take an hour and just do what we're doing now? Which one has the better long-term effect? That's what I wonder about. And I guess that this is maybe something we could discuss and debate, and you can, you know, give your ideas. I've kind of decided that review is important maybe in the younger grades, but in high school we're just gonna, I tell my students at the beginning of the year, review is up to you. You're getting a test. If you reviewed, you'll do well, and if you didn't, you're not gonna do well. But we're gonna take our hour a day and just soak. And so the interesting thing is, I've been doing that approach for years, and I give review tests. And I say, semester review coming up next week, get ready for it. And they'll be like, oh boy, you know. And another thing at the final. But the interesting thing is I do almost nothing with review. But ironically, spending so much time just on inspirational exploration and the retention is still high. Does that make sense? Because there's just something about the interest level that just freezes in the brain. I don't get it. Yep, stories. When the interest is high, the retention is high. But review still is important. All right, so with that in mind, let's talk about broad exploration. That would be the fourth reason. Broad exploration. And this is where it gets frustrating, because how do you find the time? So I don't know your school setting and how maybe you have worked to try to eke out more time in a day for all these very important subjects. So So let's think about that a little bit. Broad exposure. I like to say that a teacher is never off the subject. Talk about whatever you want. A teacher is never off the subject, especially in this course. Everything is fair game. Anything in the news, you can say, it's world cultures. Anything, it can all be discussed. You're never off the subject. It's great fun. Best way to prepare for an unpredictable future. Broad exploration. When they get out of school, they really don't know where they're going to go. They don't know what they have. They might have a little idea what. But if you've given them broad exposure, more opportunities are available. Best way to prepare for God's unknown but unfolding plan, in my mind, is to give. These are reasons why we promote a broad-based educational system. And I'm sure you do in your school as well. We have great opportunity in our day for this. Let's make use of it. All right, so there still is the time thing and the priorities thing. And so maybe we can just discuss for a little bit that diagram that I have in the middle of your sheet. That's a diagram that represents time allotment. And I have it divided into three categories, and maybe you've seen something similar to this, so you already know where we're going. But to try to help teachers, as we sit and think together about what we want a high school graduate to look like, what they want their abilities to be, to what extent we want to prepare them for broad opportunity, being able to take advantage of many opportunities, how do we focus at each step of the way in preparation of children? So every teacher is not really just free to go off on their own. There are certain things that elementary teachers should focus on, certain things that secondary teachers should focus on in order to get the end product that you want. So for elementary education, we tend to prioritize the skill subjects. If a second grade class is struggling with math facts, would you have a problem if I went down and told the second grade teacher, just put social studies on the shelf for now and focus on the math facts? We got to get the math facts up. Okay? Social studies is important. Oh, it's okay. We got something else to do. And then maybe as a reward, the things went well this week, class. Let's take an hour on Friday and do something fun. And then maybe the teacher can prepare a slideshow from Ecuador. Because you don't want to take away all the fun. You still have to have some, good. The content subjects are fun. They should be enjoyable. So I tell the elementary teachers, work on these and keep these fun. In fact, if you use CLE curriculum, this is kind of built into their ideology. The content subject tests are very simple, or at least they're supposed to be. And if you want to tell your teachers to make them even simpler, that's fine. Just enough of a test to keep them accountable, but they're going to get this someday. Introduce it at this level and focus on prioritize the skill subject. And so we think about, starting in the first grade. In first grade, we don't even teach the content subjects. It's just math, reading, and language arts. She does crafts for the fun, hands stuff. Okay? No science, no world cultures, no none of that. But as they come up through the elementary grades, we start broadening it as we can, as we have time, especially if the class is doing well. If there's a struggler, we just knock them out of a content subject to focus on this. And by sixth or seventh grade, it's time for a change. And so that's where, in our school, this is where a significant change happens. Now, we don't knock out the skill subjects. They stay. But we start throwing grades together. And maybe this is heresy for some of you, but in high school, I have grades 9 through 12. And I only teach one history class and one science class a day. Grades 9 through 12 are all in the same Bible class. They're all in the same history class. I do not teach three Bible classes and three history classes a day, the way they used to do back in the old days. Maybe some of your schools still do that. And you ought to seriously consider, if you're still making your teacher do that, start throwing some things together. Content subjects, they're not incremented like math and English. They're just facts. There are concepts that you can discuss. You might wonder, do I get in trouble? Do my ninth grade struggle? No, I have ninth grade students that make better than the 12th grade. That's just the way students are, right? Some 12th graders don't really care, so they don't do well. Ninth grader that really cares will do better than the seniors in content subjects. That tends to be how content subjects work. So we throw them together and we have an hour every day to explore, I say. Just really go deep with that. And there's still plenty of time for skill subjects. And now the life and experience is broadening considerably. Maybe not as much time given to review, but exposed to many, many things, many concepts. And by the time they graduate, it's quite broad. After life, of course, as you pursue opportunities, as you follow God's unfolding plan, you will begin to narrow your focus again, as you all probably have. You do not continue, well, yeah, you've heard the phrase, what you don't use, you lose. You've had that happen. I was out of school 13 years, and when I came back to teach, I was sure that I never had half of this English. But my teacher said, oh yeah, you did. You did. Had to learn it again. So I was following in our family business, and so I could tell you all how to run the family business. That was my focus. This will be the life pattern that people will follow. They will not near use all that you've exposed them to, but every student will follow a different plan. Every student, as you expose him to broad things, will find his little place in there. What if you never showed that to him? He might not have found it. It's one way to think about that. Now, I should stop there for just a minute or two. Any thoughts or something you'd like to add or a question? Yes.
In your content subjects where you have them all combined, do you use the exact same test, exact same assignments, or do you differentiate grading those?
Yep. Okay. So there's the advantage of a teacher that's been at it a while. You would want to be careful how you begin to work toward that if you have a new high school teacher, because I make all my own tests. I do not use the curriculum company's tests, and then I make them very fact-based, because we had the discussions in class. I'm not really worried about that. They're not going to remember all that stuff in 50 years anyway, but fact-based enough to keep them engaged, writing things down in class because they know they're going to be tested, and it keeps everyone focused, is more the idea for my tests. And so write a memory verse maybe that's practical to the discussion, a couple concepts, some terms. My students love terms tests with no word bank, just got to know. So by the end of the year, they're doing like 300 terms from the entire course, just as fast as they can go. No word bank. And they like that. They come to me a year later and say, I could still pass that test. But it's all facts-based. Now, I don't know if you caught this or not, but you all know we're living in an era of education where everything is critical thinking. Critical thinking is the buzzword. What I just told you is not buying into the critical thinking idea, but I'm okay with that. We get critical thinking in other subjects. We get it in English, we get it in writing, we get it in public speaking, we get it in math. They get critical thinking all over the place. Here's one subject. Have your critical thinking in the discussion in class, and when you go to test it, just make it some facts that 9 through 12 can all pass. If you studied it, you'll make a good grade, and moving on. Maybe you can push back on that, but I've really liked that approach.
Mm-hmm. You still use one publisher for and take through the grades that they provide?
I still use the textbook. Is that what you meant?
You go from 9th, 10th up through?
Oh, well, so I think of it more, so you're thinking broader now than this, and that's okay. So in our high school, we have four histories, say. church history, world history, U.S. history, and world cultures. And so it's a different text every year. It doesn't follow necessarily. We are very loyal to CLE. They have some great history texts. They're still working on a world cultures text, so we use Bob Jones for our world cultures. And it's an old book, but I make up for it with PowerPoint. Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to some other things. Oh man, I forget what time I'm to quit. Is it 3:45? Something like that? All right, let's move on here. So a student might find their interest. This might be one way that you would categorize this very big subject. Most of the secular people that think about this divide it into two categories, social sciences and humanities. So you can just think about how broad this subject is. The focus in the social sciences is on the institutions, more like the governments and the colleges and their influences. And the disciplines there might be anthropology, sociology, political science. You've heard of those terms. You could take those as courses in college. So it's the narrowing again, right? You've had your broad exposure, and now in life, you'll kind of pick your little pet thing. In the humanities, it's more on the individual and the creativity. The disciplines are literature, history, art and music, something like that. No person tries to do it all. But as they are exposed broadly, they find their little love, their little interest, and they run with it. It's kind of the idea that I like to think about. Let's talk about curriculum choices just a bit. We were just on that. There's been a push in recent years to get away from Baptist curriculum, especially in U.S. history, and I think that's been good. There's even been a push to say things like, I've heard well-meaning people say, I would rather use a secular U.S. history course textbook than a Baptist U.S. history textbook. And I would agree with that for the most part, but I'm not sure as time goes on if it's still good to be saying that, and for sure not in this subject. And you can probably guess why. I have an old textbook here that's secular. It's called Regions, and this is a good book, but it's old. What do you think would happen if I would get the latest edition of this? What do you suppose the focus would be? Tell me.
Gay, transgender.
Okay, we're going to have the celebrate diversity. That's one. Another big one's going to be save the planet. Yep, I get so weary of it. When I bought this, I intentionally made sure it was 10 years old. Right? And that's what you'll have. So I have not found that a Baptist textbook, it causes us a big issue because it's looking more at all cultures equally. You would have that problem more in U.S. history. So a Christian worldview obviously is going to, a textbook is going to understand God as sovereign creator, God in control, God loves all people, God will judge, restore. Those will be some of the concepts of a Christian worldview. A secular worldview in this course is going to be about evolution, celebrating diversity, save the planet, and empower the oppressed. And this one makes me really, oh man, I could go for an hour, I think. And oh man, that's a big deal in our, and you know what, actually, Gerald Miller will probably deal with some of this tomorrow in his woke talk. But that's a big one. All right, well, let's just enjoy a few more things here. Here'd be another reason. Why not learn about the physical world? And there are all kinds of things that we could talk about. I mean, this is just fun. This is a map of the world, obviously. Someone tell me what the world's most valuable resource is. What's the most valuable resource in the world?
Gold.
Gold? You're close, but I think I heard another one.
Water.
Water is the one. Not gold, not oil, but water, yeah. Okay, that's right. Fought over, labored for, died for, nothing is as important as water. And not just for drinking. Water is way more. Water is power. Water is trade. Water is, well, yeah, something to drink to stay alive.
Transportation,
yes. That's part of trade, absolutely. Who knows what percent of the world's water is fresh?
3%.
3%. How about what percent of the world's water is drinkable? Because incidentally, most of the fresh water is locked up in ice caps, which better never melt, or we're all gonna drown. The drinkable water in the world is 0.4%. I have no idea who figured that out, but that's apparently true. Okay, yes, I don't know if you ever heard of Peter Zion. He's somewhat of a controversial political science maybe is more what he is, but he wrote a book called Accidental Empires. And he likes to build the case that just by geography alone, just by placement on the map, some countries are destined to be very successful, and some countries are destined to be strugglers. And he has one country in particular that he says is the most favored nation in all the world, geographically. Could you guess which one that is? Yup, you're lucky. It is us. And of course, he's an American, so he would say that. But it is astounding how blessed we are geographically for all kinds of reasons. Now, back there when they were doing that Manifest Destiny and heading toward the West, well, yeah, you almost wonder what kind of destiny they were thinking of, because that Western seaboard has done us a lot of good. Okay, so we have two seaboards and two major inland waterways. And it just so happens that this big inland waterway here happens to be the most navigable waterway system in the world. Although China in recent years has fixed theirs up that I think they have now surpassed us on that one. But on top of that, this whole thing does happen to be right in the middle of our breadbasket. And so how can you get so blessed, right? And the other really interesting thing is you can travel 1,000 miles inland to Duluth, Minnesota, and have access to the sea. And that's a great blessing. And so other countries have said, okay, water is everything for trade. It's the cheapest way to move stuff. And they've gone to great lengths to fix up waterways. Germany has even went to this length. And that picture it disturbs me almost. I'm so used to looking at water and not seeing the bottom, and yet here we got roads going under the water. The longer I look at it, the stranger it gets. Concrete roads, and then we've got a ship, and yep, that's called the Madgeburg Water Bridge. It's 14 feet deep. Down the river they go. And so countries will spend millions, billions possibly, putting these waterways together because it's so crucial. Incidentally, one of the major ways that economies are measured in the world is by how much concrete they make. A lot of concrete went into that. And that's Germany, and of course that's a good economy. The biggest concrete maker in the world is China. Nobody even comes close. China has outdone the United States by a long shot just in the last 10 years. They have produced way more concrete than the United States has in the last 100. It's unbelievable. Watch China, they're interesting, as Donald Trump likes to say. This is another interesting map that shows a great irony. One of the poorest countries in the world is this country right here, Yemen. Maybe some of you have kept track of this with, news. And so Yemen is very poor, and yet it's great irony, they can upset the world's fruit basket. You've read this in the news, right? It's called a global economic choke point. Fascinating. So that is right here. And they're over there just, it's so interesting. So what's happening is insurance companies are saying, you're going to send that ship we insured up the Red Sea, we're double, tripling the rates. Captain's saying, you're going to send me through the Red Sea, I need double the pay. And so shipping companies say, okay, around the tip of Africa you go. And so we don't get our stuff. So the Suez Canal is suddenly, and now Egypt's worked up because that's how they make a lot of their money. And Egypt's in bad way because they're Muslim, and what an interesting situation. A poor country can throw the whole trade system. Global economic choke point. There's a geographic term for you. All right, here's a mountain and a ski resort. Maybe someone would like to guess where. Where in the world is this? Where would you guess just by looking at the mountains?
New England states.
It would look like the New England. It kind of looks like the Appalachians, right? Okay, our Appalachians are rolling, trees all the way to the top. But this is not New England.
Aspen, Colorado.
This is Colorado, yep. So Colorado has interesting mountains. They're part of the Rockies where everything is high. Yeah, actually, you can find just about everything in Colorado. But Colorado is where you go to ski, you know, it's rolling hills. The mountains are very high, but they are not prominent. You understand the difference? High, but not prominent, because everything's high. The plateaus are high, everything's high. You go to Colorado to ski, you go to Glacier National Park. Well, you don't ski here. That wouldn't feel good. Glacier activity. Here the mountains are not as high, but they are so majestic. I don't know if you've ever been to Going to the Sun Road. If you haven't, put it on your list. That road, oh, I love scaring my wife. I get up along the side, yeah, don't do this to me. And it's just a terrific road. I've never been on a better drive in my life. I've been there a couple times. It's just great. Steep, dizzying heights because of the glacier carved activity. And yet, I don't think, there might be one or two of those mountains that are over 10,000 feet, most around 8 or 9. Colorado's would be 13 and 14. This map. This mountain is the tallest mountain in Europe. Who can name it? Tallest mountain in Europe. Good guess. Let's try another one. Would you be able to tell me the mountain range that this mountain would be in? The Alps. Okay, you're all wrong. This is what everybody thinks. So today you get an education. Not the Alps, not Mont Blanc, but good guess.
Himalayas? The Himalayas?
No, that's further over here into Asia.
Is it Mount Kosciuszko?
Now you got me, because I don't know that mountain. Sorry. What country is that in?
I think it's in the Ural Mountains. But
the Ural Mountains. Okay, the Ural Mountains are lower. So there's forgotten parts of the world, and this is a forgotten part of the world. But the tallest mountain in Europe is Mount Elbrus, and it's in Russia. And it is down here in this string of mountains here called the... Your race is named after it. When you got to fill it out on a piece of paper, you put...
Caucasus.
Yeah, this is a Caucasus. Right, the Caucasus. And it's 18,510 feet high. Most people don't think of the Caucasus Mountains as being higher than the Alps, but they are. And ironically, they lie very close to the lowest spot in Europe, which is the Caspian Depression. Very similar to the United States, Mount Whitney in California is the highest mountain, and Death Valley is only 90 miles away. Ironic how that is. Mountains have created great security for people, and the plains have created great insecurity, and people of the plains, and because they do not have mountains for defense, they form armies, big conquering armies. The Huns, the Prussians. In some way, you can blame World War II on the fact that Prussia doesn't have mountains. Because in Prussia is where the concepts of nationalism really cemented an army. And what can this army do? All right, well, let's try a different landscape. This one's very flat. Who knows where this is?
Utah Salt Flat.
Okay, that's a good guess. That's what most people would say. But there is a bigger salt flat in the world than Utah, and it is in... Close. Bolivia. Bolivia. And Bolivia is sitting really good right now because the salt flats have a lot of a certain resource that is very important. What is it?
Well,
no?
Lithium.
That is if they want to dig it out. It's kind of a pain to dig lithium out and get it all. But anyway, it's there if they want it. And they're kind of maybe a little happy for that because they've been a landlocked country for years. There's a strange effect. People go to this because it is dizzying for a different reason. The majestic mountains of Glacier are dizzying, but the salt flat has its own dizziness. because the horizon is so broad and so expansive and so flat, we're used to seeing something like this at the ocean, but not in a landmass. So it has a funny effect on people's perception of distance, and so they go there to do trick photography like this. Really, the only thing the wife did there is just moved inland about 300 feet and sat down in the sand, and he kind of did the rest. Here's another guy, put his shoes there, and then walked away. And so trick photography, because of the crazy flat expanse. Who knows where this is? I find that to be one of the most fascinating landforms.
South America?
That's in China. And that's called a karst region. The same kind of area that forms caves. And then over the centuries, the caves caved in and left these towering forms. Many people go to visit that in China. All right, let's go to another reason. Maps and charts. Fast running out of time. If you want to leave, you can. I'll blubber away here for another 5 or 10 minutes. We don't have another assignment for another 45 minutes. So I'll go over time if you're okay with that. Maps and charts. Maps and charts are great fun. Don't deny your students the ability to work and to see things from charts. This helps develop spatial awareness. I heard of a girl who wanted to go off to Bible school way out in Missouri, a couple, a thousand or so miles away. And her dad said, you can't go. Don't sign up unless you can find a friend to go with. And she said, why do I need a friend? You got a car. I'll just go. Well, she definitely didn't have very, a good grasp on spatial awareness. All right, develop the big picture, connects the dots, shows advantages and opportunities. We have a city here that for centuries, I think it was 1,000 years, that Istanbul, which back then was Constantinople, Constantinople survived over 1,000 years without being conquered because it's surrounded on three sides with water. One wall to protect it, three sides of water. Not only that, but it was also sitting perfectly for trade. And so opportunities and advantages. Makes weaknesses apparent. That's another thing that maps show. And this map shows a tremendous weakness that Russia has. Russia is strangely landlocked. Russia is so big it almost suffocates itself in its bigness. And Russia, desperately. You wonder why they took Crimea? Because they wanted a way out. They desperately want a way out. That's one of the reasons. There's other cultural reasons, of course, too. But they got to have a way out. Incidentally, in this latest little fiasco that's going on over there, you've probably read this, that the Western world is begging Turkey, who owns both sides of the Dardanelles and the Bosporus, begging Turkey to shut down Russian shipping. But Turkey can't. Why? Because Russia has millions of barrels of crude oil, and Turkey needs oil, and they got to get it from Russia. And I don't know why they don't get it from Saudi Arabia, but Russia probably is cheaper and easier to get. And so Turkey is in a pickle. So those are some of the things that become apparent. And speaking of Russia, you're probably not used to seeing it from the top of the world. This is a more of a conical map. Shows a different shape of Russia. It's even hard to grasp it because on a flat map, we're not used to looking at Russia this way. Moscow's clear over here. Vladivostok is clear over here. And there's a major, major trip between there and there. So their Pacific coast is so far away, it's hardly worth bothering with. The North freezes, the Baltics freeze, and so they're left with either this little exclave over here. Did you know Russia has an exclave? Kaliningrad. And so they got to get across, Lithuania, or else this thing down here on the Black Sea, which they desperately want. And interesting. I guess Peter Zeihan would say that Russia is greatly disadvantaged. And incidentally, all their big major rivers, they all flow into the Arctic. What good is that? And so that's an unfortunate thing that Russia has to deal with. This is an interesting map. This shows Russia in a different light. Can you even find Russia? And Canada, look at Canada. So what is this map showing? Looking at this map, what would you say it's trying to show? Of course, it's greatly distorted. It's distorted according to world population, or national population. So China's huge, India's huge, Russia a sliver, and same with Canada. Yeah, so landmass does not show the story. Here's a map of Africa that shows one of Africa's major problems. This map here shows the geographical political borders that the Western world kind of forced on Africa. If you were to divide Africa up into ethnic groups, it would look like this, and this is what really matters. This is what, have any of y'all been to Africa? A couple people in Africa, you should be the one talking here. I don't know a lot about Africa, but the ethnic groups and the infighting, and it doesn't line up any with this. Which brings us to something else, another problem that Africa has, but first of all, another trivia question. What is the largest man-made object in the world?
Pyramids?
No. Not even close.
South America, Brazil.
Not even close. Nothing else comes even close to this. Largest man-made object in the world. Come on, Kendrick. No? The interstate highway system of the United States. Sorry, you weren't thinking. But it's how you got here. Okay, so China has since passed us, I think, or they're working on it. Okay, but that is one major big, and that's everything for us. If the water didn't do it, well then that does. Okay, another, it's transportation. Compare Africa's roads. They're in bad way, and half of this is not even developed yet. And so Africa has a good way to go. They are working on it, and when they do, this will alleviate some pressure, but it is also going to make the world's largest cities within the next, by 2100, the three largest cities will be in Africa. Lagos, Dar es Salaam on the in Tanzania, and Kinshasa in the Congo are projected to be the largest cities in the world by 2100. Okay, here's a map. If you want a nice map for your classroom, look up Hovia. It used to be wallpaper murals, but it's called Hovia now. That map is gorgeous. It comes as a wallpaper, any size. You can make a 6-foot by 9-foot map if you want. But I'll warn you, it is terribly hard to put up because it comes in 3 sheets, and have fun lining all those countries up. It's great fun. But that's my corner of the world, and that map is... I had one student tell me, that is the coolest thing about our school. And we have a gym. All right. I didn't even get to people. Oh, my. People are so fascinating, and they're very frustrating. And people are why we really study this subject. I'm going to expedite some things here. Let me go to kind of the end of this. One of the things that you want, the reason you want to study world cultures in these forms is because God is writing a story, and it's a fascinating story, and this is the 1040 window, of course, and students want to help. They really do. They want to be useful, and they want to help in the world. But they need to understand these world cultures because the mentality of Americans is to go in at the top, and that is one of our greatest failures in missions. You cannot go in at the top. Incidentally, since I brought that up, I should really deal with one more thing. This map here shows the core and the periphery of the world. The blue is the best. The blue is the most successful. The yellow is the next, and the red is the poor. And immigration happens from the poor to the blue, from the red to the blue. Immigration always moves that way. More immigration today than ever. Immigration moves that way, and as it moves that way, all the people melt and become like the core. If core people immigrate the other way, such as the Mennonites in Europe when they went to the Ukraine, that's going from the top down. And there, the Mennonites stayed at the top, and it created bitterness in that culture. And that's a big story in itself. So when immigration moves from top down, the people do not melt. When it moves from the bottom up, the people melt and become like the culture. The other interesting thing about this is that when production moves from the top down, things get cheap. That's why immigration moves this way, production moves the other way. And so all our stuff is made, in your Ford truck is made in Mexico, right? Because it's cheaper. If production moves from the bottom up, things get expensive. All right, enough of that. I must bring this to a close. And so God is writing his story, and we need to help people, and students need to learn to come to the bottom and serve. And that's where we need to take our young people. All right, I've got to stop, and we should have talked about people longer than we did. But maybe there's one last question or something before we move on. I'm sorry. Oh, I forgot to give you my eighth and ninth point. We ran out of time. I'll do it quick. So I basically blubbered away here on Christian worldview. And I had a lot of other things to say about that. And then, of course, people and cultures.
You went back.
Yes, I did. Oh, did I miss six, too?
Nine.
Oh, there is no nine. I was going to end up by saying, what's a ninth one? So you fill in your own blank. Sorry. I only had eight. I mean, there's 15, but we ran out of time.